The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to The Business of Giving. I'm your host, Denver Frederick, and we have two more great guests for you tonight. Eric Kessler founded Arabella Advisors 12 years ago to provide support services to some of the nation's most significant philanthropists. But today, his passion is truly around the firm's good food practice, and for some very good reasons.
Our food system is really at the root of so many problems in our society, from immigration issues to human rights issues to economic development and jobs to women's health to community development and economic development. So yes, I care about food, but I also care about the impact that our food system has on all of these other sort of deep-rooted challenges in our society.
And then you will hear from Shamina Singh, the president of the MasterCard Center for Inclusive Growth. And what exactly do they do, you may ask?
So the MasterCard Center for Inclusive Growth is a relatively new organization that was built to use the assets of MasterCard, technology, money, people, network, expertise, to really look at a very important problem of our time, and that's income inequality, through the lens of financial inclusion.
But first, the Business of Giving News Digest for Sunday, August 13th. Dozens of cities have repealed restrictions on begging to head off litigation by anti-poverty groups who have won a series of rulings against such measures. Federal judges in several states have found that ordinances unconstitutionally limit free speech. With attendance and donations dwindling and New York City property values on the rise, financially struggling religious institutions in New York City are increasingly looking to sell historic houses of worship or related development rights, touching off battles with preservation-minded neighbors. The National Institutes of Health will let the five-year-old agreement with the NFL expire this month, despite $16 million remaining of the National Football League's 2012 donation for brain injury studies. This is according to ESPN. The NFL objected in 2015 to its grant dollars funding work by an NIH-selected scientist who had been critical of the league. Students looking to claim college credit without paying anything for classes now have another option, courtesy of a project called Freshman Year for Free. The venture, unveiled this past Wednesday, includes a catalog of online courses in more than 40 subjects. And finally, after Jeff Bezos tweeted a request for ideas about how he should direct his future philanthropy, a company that specializes in harnessing the wisdom of crowds called Unanimous AI has come up with a consensus. And that consensus? Well, in third place, it was free medicine for the poor. Runner-up spot went to health clinics for the poor. And the number one way that people want Jeff Bezos to give his fortune away is for universal access to clean drinking water. And that is the Business of Giving News Digest for this Sunday evening. I'll be back to speak with Eric Kessler of Arabella Advisors right after this.
Youth opportunities, strong communities, a healthy planet. Sounds like the work of social entrepreneurs. Yes, but it's also the work of artists. Upstart CoLab is a new national collaboration connecting artists, impact investors, and social entrepreneurs. Upstart's mission is to create opportunities for artist innovators to deliver social impact at scale. Upstart is committed to promoting artists as innovators, unleashing capital for creativity and enabling sustainable creative lives. Find out more at www.upstartco-lab.org.
Well, my husband is a retired sergeant from the Air Force.
Well, he was in the Army for 14 years and an MP.
23 million veterans, they're heroes who need our help.
Well, I'm here because my daughter has had her third surgery for cancer.
We've had some difficulties, so we're here quite some time. We're going on to 3 weeks.
When our heroes' families need help, they turn to Fisher House.
We learned about the Fisher House through the doctor, and we were so grateful because who has 3 weeks to be able to come and stay at a hotel?
Fisher House is a safe, free place to stay for families of wounded warriors and veterans receiving treatment at VA and military medical centers.
Fisher House is not only a home away from home, it was like family away from family.
Thank you, Fisher House.
Thank you, Fisher House.
Helping military and veterans families. Fisher House at fisherhouse.org. Sometimes having family close by is a hero's best medicine.
A simple smile can say so much. It can say thank you, please, or even I love you. Sometimes a smile can say more than words could ever express. But what if you couldn't smile? Unfortunately, that's the sad reality for so many children today. Without the help of life-saving surgery, helpless children find themselves cast aside and all alone. But it doesn't have to be this way. To learn how you can help Smile Train, the world's largest cleft charity, change the world one smile at a time, go to smiletrain.org.
Welcome back to The Business of Giving. I'm Denver Frederick. There are not many harder decisions to start an organization, see it grow and prosper, and then, while still remaining involved with it, decide to hire a CEO to run it so you can pursue something else that has captivated you. But that is more or less the story of my next guest. He is Eric Kessler, the founder and now senior managing director of the Good Food Practice at Arabella Advisors. Good evening, Eric, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Thank you so much.
Tell us about Arabella Advisors, how you got it started, and the mission and work of the organization.
I started Arabella Advisors out of a personal experience with philanthropy. I came from a very philanthropic family and recognized early on how hard it is to be good at giving money away. And through the frustrations that I faced as a young philanthropist, decided to build a firm that provided a set of support services to some of the nation's most significant philanthropists, families, individuals, big corporate foundations, and large institutional foundations. And we as a firm wake up every day to help philanthropists have the greatest impact possible with their resources.
You know, looking at the future of philanthropy for a moment, are you observing anything now that might provide a window on where philanthropy is headed over the next 5 to 10 years?
Well, if we look at where it's been, it's pretty remarkable the transition that we've already made in the last 10 years. When I started Arabella 12 years ago, there was the words impact investing didn't exist. The Gates Foundation was a small family foundation. Warren Buffett hadn't really entered the scene as a philanthropist. And the last decade has really seen a huge transformation in philanthropy. And now what we're seeing is younger generations getting involved, the blurring of the lines between for-profit and non-profit, donors thinking about new and creative structures for their philanthropy. It's not all about setting up a foundation. There's different finance vehicles and different ways to have impact. And so I think that the next decade of philanthropy is going to be all about partnerships between donors. It's going to be about different vehicles for getting things done. It's going to be about market-based solutions. And thankfully, it's going to be about a massive influx of resources into the social sector.
That sounds exciting. So as I mentioned, you stepped away from leading the organization and decided to look at Good Food. What inspired you to get involved in food and agriculture?
Well, I stepped away as part of the original plan of the firm, which was I knew that after 10 years, having no prior experience as a consultant or running a business for that matter, I would have gotten it sort of as far as I could. And so I decided early on that at the 10-year mark, my partner and I should really relinquish day-to-day management to somebody who had a different skill set and different perspective and fresh ideas. That coincided with my growing interest in the food sector. And so I had the opportunity to move out of that chair and into a new one that I created, allowing me to work with our clients that care most about our food system. And that, for me, came from several years of work with some of the biggest foundations focused in that area and a real fascination with the notion that our food system is really at the root of so many problems in our society, from immigration issues to human rights issues to economic development and jobs to women's health to community development and economic development. And so, yes, I care about food, but I also care about the impact that our food system has on all of these other sort of deep-rooted challenges in our society. I had the opportunity to work with a number of clients over the years. It came time for this transition. I had to ask myself, am I going to go sailing or am I going to dive into food full time? And I
decided to do both.
I'm doing both, as it turns out, but principally food.
Right. Well, you know, there's increasingly more and more talk, Eric, about systems change, how you can no longer optimize one part and then optimize another. You know, you first must understand how they relate to one another and how the system works before you can make effective change. So let me ask you, is our food system broken? And if so, how is it broken?
Our food system is deeply broken in many ways. If you look at the entire good food supply chain, from how food is grown and produced to how it's picked and delivered and purchased and consumed, there's serious issues at every step of the way. And we've gone from, obviously, a place where people knew and respected their farmers to a place where most consumers are so distant from how their food is grown that there's really no connection. We think of food as what we pick up at the 7-Eleven, not the farmer's market. And so the good news is that the solutions aren't that hard. Mm. Unlike so many other issues, climate change, education reform, where it's really, really complicated, the solutions to our food system actually aren't that complicated. I think if you – given the massive demand for what I call good food, meaning coming from a food system that focuses on health and nutrition and sustainability and affordability and accessibility, the massive demand for that sort of food system in America has enabled a pretty clear set of choices and a pretty clear set of solutions. Now, getting to those won't be easy, as we know. But we can sit back and if you asked 10 different people from 10 different perspectives to imagine a better food system, those visions end up being remarkably similar.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's got to increase the frustration of the fact that it is so doable. Yeah. And it creates the urgency, too, that we can actually tackle this and do something about it if we can just get focused and make it happen. Well, one of the essential ingredients to a good food system is a culture that demands good food. Do we have such a culture at the moment?
And that's exactly where I think we're winning. Over the last decade, and you can almost sort of time it with the launching of Top Chef on television.
Yeah.
But also the growth of farmers markets and the growth of retailers who focus on this and media coverage of our food system and health and nutrition issues, the demand for good food is off the charts. And so I believe that there's three ingredients for good food. For a good food system, demand for good food, mm-hmm. Infrastructure that supports that supplies good food, and then policy that enables good food. And we're crushing it on the demand.
Yeah.
The demand for good food is at an all-time high, and it's just going up.
With everybody, but especially young people, it seems.
For sure. It's certainly generational. But now you even see this demand increasingly across almost every demographic.
Yeah,
the demand for good food is strong among rich and poor and black and white and mm-hmm. urban and rural. And so it really is sort of cross-demographic at this point.
Yeah, no pesticides, humane treatment. All those things are really becoming hot issues, I would say.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. It was astounding to me, Eric, that 40% of the food in this country is wasted. 40%! Let's start with the consumer. What are some of the reasons that Americans waste so much food?
Well, it's interesting. We live in a country of great abundance, perhaps the most abundant country in the world. And I think in many ways, the notion of, we grew up with our parents saying, don't leave any scraps on your plate. Those days are long gone for
right.
for most of America. And so I think we've become overly reliant on that abundance. At the same time, there's real sort of practical challenges, which is if you go to the grocery store and you're looking in the dairy aisle, it's impossible to make heads or tails of the date labels on food.
Well, let me ask you this. If I see a container of milk that says August 26th, does that mean sell it by that date, best used by that date, or don't drink it after that date?
And I have no idea.
Yeah.
And the reality is
that's your point, I guess.
That date labeling is complicated. But what's great, to my earlier point about easy solutions, everybody wants to fix this. Industry wants a standard. Consumers want a standard. Retailers want a standard. And so most of that waste actually happens at the retail level because they're throwing away stuff that is perceived to be bad. And so right now, just this week, we had a number of celebrity chefs in Washington, D.C. advocating with policymakers for standardized date labeling in the grocery aisles. And I think that's actually likely to succeed, which will be the single biggest factor in reducing food waste in America.
What about the cosmetic standards that consumers demand with their fruits and vegetables? It has to look just so. And I think we're living in an era right now of camera cuisine where everybody's putting a picture of what they're eating on Facebook, so it almost raises that standard a little bit.
Yeah. At the same time, I think you're starting to see places where it's cool to have the conjoined carrots or the strawberry that isn't shaped like a heart. And you look at companies like Imperfect Produce out in California, and there's others around the country that I think are making sort of ugly produce sexy.
Yes.
And so we like that
heirloom
trend.
Produce.
Exactly. We like that trend. At the same time, the reality is even if mass consumers aren't going to buy the ugly peppers, what we are realizing is that That same produce that may not look perfect, there's huge markets for those in value-added products and in commercial kitchens. And so what used to be left on the field is now finding a new home in commercial kitchens, and that's an important part of the solution.
Let me ask you another question about labeling. Where do we stand as it relates to GMO labeling, the labeling of genetically engineered foods?
This is now sort of in the hands of regulators in Washington. The Department of Agriculture is writing the rule that will determine exactly how it's labeled and what it looks like. It's stalled right now, and I think everyone on the industry side and the advocate side is encouraging the department to speed that up, because regardless of where you are on the issue and whether you think GMOs are an issue or not, what everybody wants is certainty in the market.
Yep.
And so that's where I think the advocates and the industry have come together. It's just, let's provide certainty. Now, their visions for what that certainty is of course, very different. But, you know, that's an issue that I think we really need to resolve and get off the table so we can move on to things that, in my opinion, have much greater impact on health and nutrition and sustainability.
Yeah, I would agree with you. There's been an inordinate amount of attention paid to this one issue at the expense of so many others, which are equally, if not greater, more important. You know, we talked about waste end of the consumer. What about along the supply lane, you know, supply chain from the farm to the factory to the retailer? Where are some of the big leakage there?
Well, there's leakage at every step of the supply chain. But I think what we're seeing is the farmers and the distributors who are really squeezed the most in the sort of food economy are I think, doing the greatest work to reduce that. The grocery world is a tough business to be in, so everybody is highly incentivized to reduce waste. What we need to do is to get each of these different parts of the supply chain to talk to each other to make it more seamless. But everyone has – this is a great case where everybody has the same goal, which is to reduce waste. Nobody benefits from food waste.
Is food waste recycled generally?
In some places it is. It's mandated in some cities. And certainly chefs are doing more. We have some – great restaurants here in New York, but elsewhere in the country, that are making a point of using sort of scraps from the kitchen and stews and soups in ways that really wasn't, they couldn't get away with a decade ago, but now is very much in vogue.
You know, your involvement with food is beyond Arabella Advisors. You're connected with the James Beard Foundation, obviously, and you started something called the Chef's Boot Camp for Policy and Change. What is that initiative about?
Well, it started about 8 years ago when we were trying to push for better food policy in Washington, D.C., and we realized that legislators weren't really paying attention to the advocates as much as they used to, that some of the messages were a little stale, that some of the spokespeople had sort of been around for a long time, and we needed to figure out a new way to get the attention of policymakers on these issues. And so we looked around to figure out sort of who had a captivating voice that we think would get attention, who also had a real stake in this issue. And it very quickly looked at the rise of celebrity chefs.
Oh, yeah, they become stars.
They are stars. And so I was very happy with the James Beard Foundation, whose board I sit on, to create this program that now trains chefs to be policy advocates and teaches them how to use their voice and their Twitter feeds and their restaurants and their TV appearances to really lay down the line on what a good food system looks like and the policies required for that. And so I mean, just this week we had chefs in town lobbying on food waste policy. In a month they'll come in to lobby about the farm bill. And it's pretty remarkable. You know, in the old days when Bono would walk the halls of Congress to lobby on African debt relief, you know, everybody would come out of their offices to get autographs and get their picture taken. When Tom Colicchio goes to the Senate building, it's the same thing.
Wow.
It's pretty remarkable with people asking for autographs and pictures, and they really are celebrities, and they are really looking for opportunities to get out of the kitchen and to engage it beyond just their restaurants. And we're really pleased at the James Beard Foundation to give them that opportunity.
Yeah. You know, it shouldn't make such a difference in Congress, but it really does. When you have a Michael J. Fox or a Christopher Reeve or anything, you know, it really gets the attention and changes, moves the needle.
The messenger matters.
It really does. You know, one of the major objectives of the work you do at Arabella Advisors is to increase the flow of capital to support a good food system. Are investors stepping up to the plate?
investors are absolutely stepping up to the plate on multiple levels. So individual investors and family philanthropists are putting more and more philanthropic dollars and investment dollars into food businesses. We manage a small private club of investors who are putting money into startup food companies in the good food supply chain. But you also look at the other end of the spectrum. Industry is stepping up. And so you have, you know, large traditional food companies from General Mills to Campbell's Soup who are all making their own sort of venture investments in good food businesses, and from, you know, the acquisitions that they're doing to R&D on new products. And so from across that spectrum, from industry to individuals, there is a lot of capital on the sidelines looking for opportunities to have an impact.
Yeah, those companies have to do it almost. As you said, the culture is changing, the demand is there, and for their very survival, they just better, you know, get involved in that line of business. Give us an example of one or two companies that are engaged in this work that could really benefit from the flow of capital or who have benefited from that flow to help support their enterprise.
Well, we look at about 200 companies at a time that are sort of out raising money. And I mentioned Imperfect Produce is a great company out in California we like a lot that is raised money for their business. We just helped some clients of ours make investments in a company called Rebound, which is creating some really innovative refrigeration technology and the cold chain is a critical part of our food system. We're looking at sustainable agriculture companies. One of the biggest challenges in the food world is the conversion from traditional agriculture to organic agriculture. There's some great investment funds and companies that are providing financing to sort of bridge that gap where farmers have to grow organically but don't yet have the benefit of the organic label.
That's right. They have to do it for a number of years, so they have to pay the piper, but they don't get to charge the premium, and that can be a tough patch.
That's exactly right. So we have a group called Good Food Ventures we created, which is a small private club of individual investors who we think are making direct investments into some of the most innovative companies in the sector. And there's hundreds of them, and there's such a need for innovation in the food world. It's a pretty remarkable time to be an investor in the food sector. I make a number of my own private equity investments in food businesses as well, and it's a really exciting time.
Sure is. Let's turn our attention to food policy at the federal level for a moment. You know, when you have an issue, Eric, that cuts across so many different departments and dozens of agencies, what's your strategy for getting effective policy measures enacted?
Well, right now, we need to think about food policy in terms that resonate with the current political reality in Washington. And whether we like that reality or not, it's the reality in which policy is being made. And so we may feel passionately about organics. We may feel passionately about community development. But right now, everything that we talk about on policy needs to be translated into economic development and jobs.
Yeah.
That is what matters to policymakers, and that's the currency in Washington. Mm-hmm. The good news is that virtually everything that we care about in food policy can be translated to economic development and jobs because the consumer demand is at an all-time high. And so this is all about an economic argument, which is to say businesses and policymakers need to rise to the occasion of giving consumers what they want, whether they're urban or rural or rich or poor or black or white or Republican or Democrat. The demand is there, and we need to provide a policy environment that enables a good food system to meet that demand.
You know, notwithstanding the need for a comprehensive approach and dealing it, you know, with this from a systems approach, is there a particular piece of legislation or reform that is currently at the top of your priority list?
Well, the biggest piece coming up is the Farm Bill. The Farm Bill, most Americans don't know there is a Farm Bill, much less the details of it, and I'm jealous of them for that. But the Farm Bill is a piece of legislation. It's one of the largest sort of funding mechanisms in the federal government. It provides crop insurance. It provides all of the what used to be called food stamp dollars is now SNAP dollars. The Farm Bill is really the economic engine of our food system in America, and it has to be everybody's first priority at the moment, because it is under attack. All of the programs in the Farm Bill that support a good food system are have a target on their back. And so everybody has lots of other ways to use those dollars. And these are dollars that pay for conservation programs, so that enable sort of long-term sustainability for our agriculture system. It provides funding for farmers markets so that farmers markets in low economic areas can provide greater amounts of fresh produce to communities that, that perhaps need it most. And so that is, you know, that is absolutely at the center of everybody's priority list right now. It's coming fast and furious. And if you watch the sort of food movement, you will start to see in this fall a real focus on farm bill advocacy that will carry into next year. It's a tough political environment. And so our goal right now is really just to not take away anything. Yeah. We just want to keep it going. It's working well. We're showing progress. We're moving people off of food stamps. We're seeing conservation go up and sustainability increase. And so we just don't want to turn our back on programs that work.
Yeah. Let me talk a little bit about your journey at Arabella. And I know when you start an organization or a firm like this, it's a B corporation now, it becomes your baby in a way. And although you said that 10 years ago you planned on stepping aside and having someone else lead the organization, that is usually a very, very tough and difficult decision when the time actually comes. What was it like for you and going through this process that ultimately had you act on that decision?
Well, letting go isn't easy. And as a serial entrepreneur, I'm certainly can attest to that. At the end of the day, I was really motivated by what was best for myself personally, for our clients, but most importantly, our staff. And I think bringing in fresh leadership with a different perspective and a different skill set was right for everybody. And so over the 2 years that our CEO, Sampriti Ganguly, has run the company, that's certainly been proven to be the case. And so our CEO, coming from a professional services background, has enabled our team to do their job better than we have before. Our clients see the results of that. And for me personally, it's enabled me to focus on the things that I'm best at and that I care most about. I still get to opine and I still get to help influence, but I'm pretty proud of having been able to, perhaps for the first time in my life, actually let go of something that I've built. And it's working incredibly well. So the decision is reinforced every day.
That's great. You know, Arabella Advisors has an exceptionally high rating on websites like Glassdoor, where people, you know, where employees weigh in on what it's like to work at a particular place or organization. Tell us about the corporate culture of Arabella Advisors and why the people who work there say such wonderful things about it.
Well, it's good to hear. I've never actually looked at Glassdoor.
You should.
I also don't look at Yelp reviews of the restaurants that I'm invested in, but it's good to hear. From the beginning, my partner Bruce Boyd and I have really focused on building, we think, a pretty unique culture and one that we aspire to be the best place any of our employees will ever work. I'm not sure that we still have a lot of work to deliver on that promise, but it's a promise we made and something we aspire to every day. You know, for me, that comes from a deep family history with a family-owned business that really prioritized this before it was in vogue. And so, you know, we believe that when you look at our culture and our benefits and the professional development opportunities, the way in which we sort of aggressively promote people and leapfrog their careers, that it's pretty unique. You know, nowadays, you know, hiring and managing millennials, that sort of culture is now commonplace and is sort of demanded among them. Mm-hmm. I hope that we're over-delivering on that. Again, we certainly have more room to go, but when we do our annual retreat every year and we bring our 150-some people together and our in-house band, which comprises of 20 people from across the country, play their one gig of a year, it's the best corporate party ever thrown, those are the moments that we really cherish as a firm.
And the firm is really putting a lot of energy into building diversity and equity and inclusion from the inside out at the moment.
We are, and I'll be the first to say we've got a lot of work to do there. We're working hard. I think we're making some progress in some ways, lots of progress in other ways. We're the first to say that we, along with I think most people in our sector, have a long way to go to account for inherent bias in the social sector, in the philanthropy world that isn't necessarily known for diversity, equity, and inclusion. And so I would modestly say that we've made some progress, but we're trying to hold ourselves accountable to where we really need to get to, which is much further forward than where the sector is today.
Well, that's the hallmark of great cultures. You're never satisfied.
Yeah.
So let me close with this, Eric. There are some 40, 50 million people in this country who are food insecure, unsure in many cases where their next meal is going to be coming from. And many of those people live in food deserts where healthy and nutritious food simply isn't available in their neighborhoods. How quickly can this situation be successfully addressed? And what are the one or two things that need to happen immediately to see that it is done sooner rather than later?
Well, there's a lot that is being done. Food access is a real inherent problem in our food system, and it's tied directly to institutional racism and economic disparities in America. I'm really happy to see some companies standing up. One company that I'm a personal investor in called Brandless, and other grocers that are really focusing on sort of democratizing food and getting good food, making good food accessible for all. So I think part of it is, you know, looking community by community and understanding what the particular needs are of that community. I sit on the Food Policy Council for the mayor of Washington, D.C., and in our city, we have a significant part of the city that really is food insecure with remarkably poor food access, where really the only choice is to grab a candy bar from the convenience store. The issues are tough. They're really entrenched in some of these much bigger societal issues. The solutions aren't as tough. In that we know that what we need is different formats of stores. We need them in places that really matter to people, that really speak to the needs of the community, who, you know, may be taking two buses home, may not have a car, they can't go to Costco. So there's a lot of good stuff happening. Part of it is institutional framework and investing in these businesses and enabling them to set up shop in places where there isn't great food access. A big part of it is policy change and using good policy to eliminate the roadblocks to food access, but also to incentivize food access and incentivize businesses to go into these communities that need it the most. So I think the trend's in the right direction. I think there is so far to go, and it's certainly something that Arabella and our good food team and so many of our foundation and philanthropy clients is focused on right now. And for that, we're really proud to be at sort of the center of trying to put these solutions in place.
Well, Eric Kessler, the founder and senior managing director of Arabella Advisors, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. For people who are interested in learning more about this topic or more about Arabella, where can they go to get that information?
ArabellaAdvisors.com.
There you go. Well, thanks, Eric. It was a real pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you so much.
I'll be back with more of the Business of Giving right after this.
Most teachers spend more than $500 of their own money on school supplies each year. That's because too many classrooms lack books, microscopes, art supplies, and even pencils. At DonorsChoose.org, you can help students and teachers get the resources they need for a successful education. Whether you support a field trip to a local museum, yoga mats for a health class, or technology to teach kids to code, you can join the 2 million individuals who've already made a difference in the classroom. Visit DonorsChoose.org to bring a classroom dream to life. Technology can change lives, but underserved communities around the world have yet to experience all the benefits technology offers. Benetech is a nonprofit whose mission is to empower communities in need by creating scalable technology solutions. Their work has transformed how 500,000 people with disabilities access information, made it easier and safer for human rights defenders to document violations, and equipped environmental conservationists to protect ecosystems. Learn more by visiting Benetech.org. Babies sure don't come with manuals. And for their moms living in poverty, it can feel impossible to make ends meet. Thankfully, there's Nurse Family Partnership to help new moms be the best they can be. Their nurses are always there for moms throughout pregnancy and after the baby comes home. A mom can change her baby's world. Nurse Family Partnership can help guide her there. Join in changing the future for babies born into poverty. Visit supportnfp.org. If you're interested in reading transcripts of guests' interviews from the Business of Giving, you can find them at denverfrederick.wordpress.com. And now back to the show on AM 970, The Answer. Can you help?
Try to imagine your life if you were completely locked out of the financial system. No banking or checking account, no credit or debit card, no record of transactions or credit score, no access to loans or other financial instruments. And many of the records that help prove that you are you, well, they would have never existed. There are 2 billion such people in that very predicament around the world. The MasterCard Center for Inclusive Growth didn't think that was right, while also seeing them as potential customers, and decided to do something about it. And here to tell us what that was and is their president, Shamina Singh. Good evening, Shamina, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
So what is the MasterCard Center for Inclusive Growth, and what's your main focus?
So the MasterCard Center for Inclusive Growth is a relatively new organization that was built to use the assets of MasterCard, technology, money, people, network, expertise, to really look at a very important problem of our time, and that's income inequality, through the lens of financial inclusion.
Mm-hmm. And what you're doing here really kind of plays into your theory of change, which is connecting people to networks.
Yeah.
Explain that to us a little.
It's really interesting. It's very simple if you start to think about it, but it's not something I thought about every day. But the truth is that there are these informal and formal networks that drive the modern economy. They're either social networks like Facebook, like Snapchat, things like that. There are physical networks like water, electricity, internet, I guess.
Yeah.
And then there are these virtual networks, like your banking account, if you're transacting online, your buying and selling online, commerce, letters of recommendation and referral. These things that connect you up into possibility and to what we call productivity, that allow you to maximize your own talents and resources. And so if you think about these networks, and there are a lot of barriers to these networks, there are a lot of enablers to these networks, and there are a lot of barriers. And so what the center is really trying to do is look at these networks in a very scientific way, but also a very real methodical way to say, how do we figure out how to break down the barriers to the various networks that stop people from reaching their economic potential? Or more focused, how do we help businesses and entrepreneurs in particular reach their full potential as business owners?
Interesting. You know, before we get too deep into the work of the center, MasterCard is a bit of an enigma to many people. Some people think it's a credit card company. Other people think it's a bank. Perhaps it's neither. What is MasterCard?
Well, I think it's a great question to level set for everybody. I mean, and it's interesting because I'm somebody who comes out of the public sector. So I spent my whole life working for labor unions, for grassroots activist organizations, for the government. And so if you would have told me, I don't even know, 10 or 15 years ago, that I'd be working for a company that basically connects buyers and sellers through technology, I wouldn't have predicted it in 100 years. But again, if you think about the power of that technology, and that's really what MasterCard is. Mm. It's the rails that connects buyers and sellers who can't see each other. So for example, if you shop online at any platform company or Etsy or whatever, and you swipe that card or you tap that phone or whatever, that information goes usually, if you're using a MasterCard, goes on that network.
Mm-hmm.
And they will transfer the information that says, you're Denver, I'm Shamina, you have money in your account, you want to get money from his account to purchase a product, let's go ahead and make this transaction happen. And it happens in less than a blink of an eye.
Mm-hmm.
So that's some serious technology. And it's in 212 places around the world, connecting billions of people with millions of banks and opportunities to buy and sell.
Well, speaking of billions of people, as we said, there are 2 billion people who are currently locked out of the formal financial system. What are some of the barriers they face that prevent them from being included?
Well, I'll give you a really personal example. And just to put perspective on 2 billion, by the way. So think about 7 billion people in the world.
Right.
2 billion completely cut off. Probably 4 billion who are off and on inside the formal and the informal economy. Mm. And that's important because for me personally, my parents are from, I'm a first generation. My parents are from India.
Right.
And when my mother was born, she was born without formal identification. And so it's a little known fact that not every country in the world provides a piece of paper that says, I'm Shamina Singh, you know, this is where I'm born, this is who I say I am. And so when you don't have that recognition from a government or from some sort of, you know, third-party entity, it's really hard to do things like go to college, go to school, get a bank account, get connected up into a network that gives you access beyond your own geographical space. And so that's what financial exclusion is really about. It's about the inability and the problems that come when you're confined to your geographically to where you live, and you can't really transact beyond yourself
mm-hmm.
or beyond the person next to you, because all you have is a currency, a piece of paper, a cash, whatever. So if you're not included in a financial economy, you're really living in a world that is very confined.
Yeah. I think in the case of your mom, didn't they use a rope to keep track of her age?
Yes, you've done your research. Oh, my gosh, yes. So for girls in the village, they would tie a knot around the time you were born every year to try to keep track.
Yeah.
But if you think about it, I mean, think about my mother. I mean, just staying with that example for a second, and this idea of networks. So she was born in a village
mm-hmm.
in India, didn't have a birth certificate, married, grew up in the village and grew up in Delhi, married my father. They had an arranged marriage, and which was also very productive because I have four sisters, so that was a good thing. But moving from the village to the city, my father moved to the United States to complete his education. He moved from an area of, at the time, lower productivity to an area of higher productivity.
God, yeah.
to reach more maximum levels. He brought my mother over with the children and sort of brought us to a place that allowed us to reach even more of our potential.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really a human example of how networks drive the modern economy. And the closer you are to networks that allow you to achieve your potential or your gifts or your talents, the more successful you'll be.
Mm-hmm. A good example of that. Does technology play a role in financial inclusion, getting more people included? And if so, how so?
Technology is a massive enabler of financial inclusion. I mean, I'll tell you, and you know this probably from all of your shows and everything you do, that this is an enormous time of change. But it's an enormous amount of time for opportunity. So there is this enormous convergence of technology with things like data, with things like artificial intelligence, but also this enormous need, this enormous amount of human suffering that's still happening around the world. And so we have all the tools at our disposal to solve these problems or to at least address the challenges.
Yeah.
And so what makes me very interested in this work, and to get back to your question about technology, is that we have an enormous enabler of human potential called technology that exists today that's constantly changing.
Well, let's say I'm illiterate, okay? How can technology help me become part of the financial system?
So if you can't read, and frankly, this is something we've come across in a lot of our work, you have voice recognition sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And so in some of our projects, especially with government social subsidy programs, a lot of times we will allow the registration for the program to include a voice recognition so that if you want to draw down your benefit or if you want to make a banking transaction, you can simply dial the number on your phone and say, "Hi, I'm Shamina Singh, voice ID," and then the money comes straight into your account. And then you can start to transact using either your phone or a card or whatever it is that's easy for you.
Very cool. You know, a topic that I know interests you deeply is the cost of cash, which is a bit of an oxymoron. It took me
right.
a while to get my arms around that. What is the cost of cash?
I know. Did you ever think that there are costs to cash? Here's what's interesting about cash. Cash has no friends.
Mm.
So unless you're doing, well, I can't say that. Unless there's some reason why you want to transact in a way that is without identification
yeah,
or without
yeah,
trace.
Right.
And so in that community, cash has a lot of friends.
Oh, but, sure. In the sketchy community.
Well, potentially.
Yeah.
But the cost of cash, if you think about it, and we've actually done studies to show that from a country perspective, it can cost a country anywhere from, 0.05% of their GDP all the way up to 2% of GDP, depending on how much time, energy, effort is spent driving cash somewhere, having people guard the cash, transacting in cash in a way that means you have to have, depending on where you are,
mm-hmm.
you have to have an enormous amount of security
yep.
around that cash. And then you have to bundle up the cash at the end of the day, put it in a bag or do whatever you're going to do, and then hope that nobody sees you going to your bank to make that late night deposit into the late night deposit box.
Mm-hmm.
That's just one example of sort of the
standing online, all those things. A lot of time involved.
A lot of time involved. And if you think about maybe, you know, for countries who may get their benefits or may get their paychecks and things like that in more physical form, people spend days waiting in line to get their check or their, you know, their voucher. And especially with this refugee crisis, you can only imagine how much time people are spending and how dangerous it is to get your, maybe your refugee aid or your humanitarian aid in the form of money when you're maybe you're living in a camp. And so you're surrounded by people who are in a very tough predicament. And so there are enormous physical costs of cash and economic costs of cash. And what we found is that 85% of transactions in the world today are still done in cash.
Mm-hmm.
Only 15% are actually digital. So if you think of a company like MasterCard, that's an enormous amount of actual running room in terms of the business proposition, which is also the other reason why we wanted to really focus on financial inclusion. Because at the end of the day, not only do we want to make sure people are connected up into the formal economy, but we want to make sure that MasterCard as a business entity isn't so focused on the top 1% of the world, and then they leave everybody else behind.
So your competition really is not Visa, it's cash.
Well, I don't know about that. But no, it really is about, I mean, if you think about the enormous business opportunity, it's a world where, you know, you really want people to go digital.
Mm-hmm. Well, MasterCard Center, you have set a goal to get 500 million more people included in the financial system by 2020. That is one ambitious goal. What exactly will you do to see that will happen?
Well, I'll tell you something. The company, so it's interesting. Our CEO often says, look, we can have the internet of everything, but without the inclusion of everyone, we haven't done our job as a company that wants to do well and do good. And so the financial inclusion goal is actually a corporate objective.
Okay.
And so it's written into our MasterCard's corporate goals,
mm-hmm.
which means when you write something into your corporate goals, it means everybody at the company is measured on it.
Well, that's got to make your life a lot easier.
It does. It makes the life a lot easier. But the 500 million is about using our business resources and our philanthropic resources together to make sure we're not only connecting them up, but we're doing it in a responsible, purposeful way. Mm-hmm. So my job in that 500 million piece is to make sure that we are doing it the right way. We have training, we have education programs, we're testing and learning all the time about what works and what doesn't. What does it mean to be financially included? What does it really mean? Is it, you know, does it mean you can transact? Does it mean you can save? Does it mean you can purchase? So looking at all of the issues around it. But the 500 million itself comes from working with governments usually around the world to make sure that they transition from normally they've been doing cash-based, you know, either taxes or government benefits or pensions or things like that. If you can imagine, in most countries, it's done in cash and paper, not in electronic, mm-hmm. like it is in the United States. And so really working with governments to partner with them to make sure that we can work together to digitize their social subsidy programs.
And the other side of it would be the retail side of the ball. You have the merchants, and I know you set a goal there of 40 million micro merchants by 2020. What are some of the programs you have in that area?
Well, you know, it's interesting because, like I said, we want to do this the right way. We want to make sure that we're not just including people just to get them connected, and then what we see a lot of times is people will sign up, but then they don't transact or they don't use it. So they're not really enjoying the benefits of being financially included. You have to include the places where people shop, and you have to include the places where people spend their money that once they are financially included, they can actually shop. They can actually use their digital payment or do whatever they're going
to
do.
Merchant has to take it.
Merchant has to take it. So, but the other piece is because it's MasterCard, the credibility of and the trust that comes when you're using a digital form of payment is critically important. And that's a huge lesson. That was a huge lesson for us. To financially include somebody is not enough. They have to trust that when they purchase something or when they leave their money in an account and they can't see it physically, that what is supposed to happen with their money happens with their money. And having a brand name like MasterCard, where it is accepted all over the world, it's a really important piece of the equation. So yes, the 500 million through strong programs with governments and businesses and things like that, but also the 40 million on the merchant side to make sure that the trust between the buyer and the seller is really there. And that's something that we can deliver on the MasterCard network.
And as you said, part of your job is to be sure that is all done consistent with the values of the MasterCard company.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, the values of the company are there across the board. But what we have the opportunity to do at the center is put the research behind it, actually test and learn. Like, mm-hmm. what are the best ways to do it? We have theories on what the right ways to do it are. But really, if you have a if you have a company who's doing this, you get to invest research. You get to test and learn. You get to have focus groups. You get to really look under the hood and
sure.
say, did this intervention work? Why didn't it work? What can we do better next time? So it's a real process of iteration and mm-hmm. learning in real time. And so unlike some other, I think some other more traditional think tanks, we at the center are really learning as we go. Mm-hmm. So we haven't made it a practice to spend years on developing some sort of theory and a research and this whole, and a lot of academic work. And then sort of start to test and pilot and learn and sort of spend 15 years trying to figure something out. What we've said is, look, no, we have access to an amazing resource with the MasterCard data and the network of people that are all around the world. So why would we sit back? Why don't we go ahead and get into the market and start working with nonprofit organizations and social enterprises and other learning and teaching organizations to really see what's happening on the ground and try to understand what businesses really want versus what we think they want.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
that's a difference in how we do our work.
No, it's a little bit Silicon Valley there. And, you know, I know what they say out there is that if you've developed a product and when you introduce it, people don't laugh at you, it means you've waited too long. So get it out, get the feedback,
get it out,
and then
yeah.
they get back to the drawing board
right.
and get another one out real fast.
Right, exactly.
Well, another way you would never get this done is if you try to do it yourself. And you have 500 partnerships.
At least at this
point. At least, that's right. People such as Mercy Corps, which is working with you in Indonesia. People like Ramin.
Yes.
Andrea Jung has been on the show. Tell us a little bit about your approach to engaging partners and, you know, some of the successes that you've had with them.
Sure. So just on the 500 number, these are businesses, nonprofits, humanitarian
sure.
aid organizations. So we're not confined to nonprofit and
sure.
philanthropic. This is across the board.
Mm-hmm.
So one example with Grameen, since you raised it, we worked with Grameen to help them upgrade their back-end technology. So before, if you know, as you learned with Grameen, the women in the Grameen system apply for a loan.
Yep.
They get some, you know, risk underwriting, and they have to go through a whole process to figure it out, and then they may get cash, or they'll get a check, or they'll get something like that, and then they can go on about their business. What we worked with Grameen to do, along with Citi and Apple, was to say, can we build up the technology in such a way that they can cut the time it takes to do all of that handwritten paper process work, consolidate the risk and the underwriting and the loan documentation and things like that, and then help these women get on their way much more faster. And so we invested in the technology to help ensure that I think it's 70,000 entrepreneurs are now transacting digitally versus using that paper product and that paper process. And I think it's been an enormously helpful intervention for
them.
Oh,
I bet it has. Let us turn our attention, Shamita, to humanitarian aid for a moment. And what happens often is that people receive these paper vouchers, and then they go to the concession or whatever, and they are entitled to receive some water and some blankets and some tents. How can a digital system make that process more efficient and more effective?
Right. So think about what you just said. So imagine if you have the stress of being on the run, if you will. So
yeah.
you've left your home, you've left everything you've ever known, and you're moving and you're walking to another country, another place. The last thing you want to think about is how you're going to feed your family. I mean, that's all you're thinking about, but that's the last thing you should have to worry about. The other thing that we learned is the dignity, right? So you have left everything and you're trying to figure out who you are again. The work of the humanitarian organizations is so important, and our partnership with them is profound. So what we're working with them to do is say, look, instead of shipping all of these tents and all of these things from around the world, you know, bringing the grain in, why not work with the local host economy to feed their economy in such a way that the aid goes in to the refugee themselves?
Oh, that's very smart.
So that the refugee has then the choice
mm-hmm.
on how they purchase, what they buy, what they need the money for, and it feeds the local economy. So they're going in with a MasterCard into a grocery store, and they're buying the food that they need for their family, just like anybody else.
Sure.
So it not only raises their productivity, right? So it not only allows them to transact and live and, you know, sort of assimilate much more quickly into the community,
mm-hmm.
but it provides a level of dignity.
Sure, it treats them as a person.
And a respect that is much less punitive and mm-hmm. shouldn't be. And so we really value the partnerships with World Food Program, Mercy Corps, the International Rescue Committee, Save the Children. These are all organizations doing incredible work, and the opportunity to help them do it better is absolutely rewarding.
And I would imagine it also helps eliminate a lot of the corruption, because
absolutely.
When you have a piece of paper with a bunch of things on it, you give it to somebody and they give you one thing back and you don't know if you're going to get the other items there. So it really is a wonderful safeguard in that regard.
Exactly. And that's the bit about working on the ground,
yeah.
hand in hand, because one of the things we found is that even if you have a paper voucher that says, look, you're allowed to have 10 bushels of corn
mm-hmm.
or two bags of rice or 10 bottles of water, if you take that piece of paper sometimes to people who are not as interested in being
yes.
fair
yes.
or transparent, they might say, look, we're going to take your piece of paper that says you get 10 bushels of corn. We're only going to give you two.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want the two, give us the piece of paper for the 10. And then we're going to trade that 10 on the black market.
Yeah.
And so unless the customer is in charge and has an ability to transact just like you or me.
Sure.
It really opens the door to a lot of corruption, a lot of fraud, and a lot of wasted taxpayer dollars. Because remember, at the end of the day, this aid is coming from countries.
Yeah, or charitable contributions.
Or charitable contributions mm-hmm. that are from people who are working hard for their money. And so you want to make sure that every dollar we invest as a person or a country or a community is spent in the best way.
You know, let us turn to another realm of your work. And there are huge and enormous inequalities in access to data information and the ability to use it. It's a data divide, I guess you would say. Mm-hmm. And on the other side of that divide, unfortunately, are social sector organizations mm-hmm. and nonprofits.
Mm-hmm.
MasterCard is dedicated to closing this gap through something called data philanthropy. Tell mm-hmm. us what this is about and what you're doing.
Well, it's an enormously important issue. You know, I think we're all focused on income inequality, and we feel it and we know what that is. But I think one of the things that we found at the MasterCard Center is that there is an information inequality gap that is real and growing very fast. And if we don't tackle that information inequality gap, income inequality is not going to be something that we're going to even remember.
Mm-hmm.
The ability to process information, to make better decisions, to analyze, enormously important.
Yeah, the bigger game.
The bigger game.
Mm-hmm.
So think about people, you know, everybody hears about big data. Everybody hears about artificial intelligence, machine learning, and things like that. You're hearing about it, but you're hearing about it on the business side of the
house.
That's
right.
And so, which is fantastic because
mm-hmm.
it's very powerful. But what we're trying to do with the center is sort of say, look, we would like to work with social sector organizations and government organizations to make sure that they're also benefiting from the enormous power of data. And so we are working with some social organizations to say, look, how can we either help you understand your own data better in a way that helps you make better decisions and faster decisions? In some situations, we're actually working with universities like Harvard.
Right.
We gave them a data grant. And I don't know if it's one of the first data grants that it's certainly one that I've ever heard about, but they have a very interesting research proposal. And they said, look, if we had access to MasterCard transaction data, it would really help accelerate our learnings around the importance of knowledge and how business transactions are really helping solve problems in countries. And so we said, okay, let's try it. And so for the first time, we gave a data grant. We gave them access to data in a way that really helped them. And the last thing I'll say about this is that if we think about philanthropy and we think about corporate social responsibility, that's about using a company's assets
mm-hmm.
for social good.
Right.
So let's look at our assets as a company.
And your core competency.
And our core competency. And so it can be money, but money's not enough. The check writing days are over around corporate responsibility. What you really want when you're partnering with a company is to use their assets, their brains. And for MasterCard, data expertise is a core competency and
yep.
one that we want to use to help change the world.
Yeah, that's where the multiplier really kicks in. Where a check is just a check, this really
has... has an endpoint.
Yeah.
There's an exponential partnership that you can have when you're really utilizing the expertise of an organization.
Let me close with this, Jamina. Your work spans the globe. Is there any particular place or community where your efforts have been particularly successful and gratifying in including more people in the financial system? And what has that transformation been as a result?
Well, I think, I mean, you go every day and you can see it, right? So I look in New York City, and I'm a New Yorker. So I look at the, you know, I have to go from a subway to a bus to sometimes to an accessor ride and things. And I just kind of look at the city in a whole different way now that I'm working for a company that connects technology and networks. And so so I see an enormous amount of potential. There have been places where I've seen the thing work. So South Africa, I would say, is a government program that we worked with the South African Social Security Agency to register 20 million South Africans in under 1 year. And those South Africans are now all have bank accounts, and they're transacting digitally on their social benefit side.
That's great.
Which has transformed their lives in a real way. But I also walk around places like New York City, and I look at the potential. And even here at home, I want everybody's lives to be better. And so the work is never going to be finished. And I'm just delighted that I get to be in a position where I can focus on it.
Well, you seem to be a very happy person.
I'm a tired person, but it's a gratifying experience.
Well, Jamina Singh, the president of the MasterCard Center for Inclusive Growth, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. For listeners interested in learning more about this work, where can they go to find that information?
They can go to MasterCardCenter.org.
Thanks, Jamina. It was a real pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you.
And that is this week's show. Next week, my guest will be Glenn E. Martin, a formerly incarcerated criminal justice advocate and the founder and CEO of Just Leadership USA. One of their primary goals is to see that Rikers Island is closed. Thanks for listening. Have a great week, and I hope you'll return next Sunday evening for the business of giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of the Business of Giving.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.